Welcome to Packet Pushers, possibly the greatest data networking podcast on the internet today. See, if you define a small enough niche, you can easily be the greatest. It's like playing American football in the world championship because nobody else in the world actually plays. So you're going to be the best in the world when you're the only people that plays the game. That's how we work. Well, that's enough marketing for today. Now, MPLS has been at the butt of many jokes around here in Packet Pushers virtual hall, and most engineers agree that MPLS is far from perfect, but it's the best we could manage, which is pretty sad considering just how far we've come over the last 20 years in almost every aspect of computing except networking. Two decades old means for most people that it's proven and everyone understands it and we can't change it now, it runs the internet, and many other similar excuses just like those. The litany is long. Which begs the question, how did we get here? What's the history behind MPLS? Why is it the way it is instead of something else? Why didn't we stick with long-forgotten, much better technologies like FDDI or ATM? I'm just joking. So today we are fortunate to be joined by a team of people who were actually there when in the very nascent incubation period when MPLS was called tag switching and emerged in the world. We've got three people to sing the song of the history for you so that you can be part of the song line that takes us forward. So let's go through and introduce ourselves. Tom, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience? Tell them just briefly about yourself.
Yeah, hi. I'm Tom Nadeau. I've actually been on your podcast before. I've kind of been around the industry, you know, doing various things, you know, including, you know, working with these fine gentlemen early on in my career and them helping me push my boat in the right direction in the pond, which I thank them both for. And, you know, most recently I've been focusing on NFV and SDN and open daylight, open source, various open source kinds of projects. Mm-hmm. And, that's kind of where we got to arrive at the discussion we're having today.
All right. And Dan, where did you come from?
So I used to be a distinguished engineer at Cisco. I got burned out about 10 years ago, and I haven't been doing networking since. I was in MPLS at the beginning. There were a bunch of us that were part of the Cisco Lightstream acquisition, which was an early ATM switch / networking product. It's a very long, complicated story, and if you're familiar with Cisco's acquisition strategy, you'd understand it, but a short version is eventually Cisco bought another ATM product, and we had a team of high-powered engineers sitting around looking for something to do. At which point, luckily just about that time, Jakob Rechter came up with the idea of tag switching. Eric Rosen was in our group, and I believe he had some ideas in that area earlier on, so he kind of got together with Yakov and started working on the architecture. Marketing guys got excited about it because there was a competitor at the time called Ypsilon.
Yeah.
Which had come up with a flow-based way of using ATM switches to do routers, they thought. Nobody in the technical area believed they had a chance because it was basically the flow-based stuff that hadn't worked in the 7500. But marketing saw a threat. So
yeah.
Willing to jump on
to that
switching idea.
And finally with us today is George Swallow. George, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself?
So like Dan, I was also a distinguished engineer at Cisco, now retired. And I've been and still am the chair of the MPLS work group of the IETF since it was founded. Mm-hmm. And I actually had the privilege to be present at the very birth of tag switching, which evolved into MPLS. And that occurred at the IETF in Los Angeles in 1996. Ypsilon was there, and they, for the first time, revealed exactly what they were doing.
Yeah.
And I had attended this. And coming out of it, I bumped into Yakov Rechter and Tony Lee. And explained to what they were doing and, you know, using source destination addresses to create a flow and, you know, divide it up into cells and send it across and reassemble it on the far side. And they actually stripped off the IP header and made it reappear on the other side.
Yep.
Yakov immediately said, great idea, but it should have been packets. And it should have been NLRI. And for your listeners who might not know what that is, that network layer routing information, or for the IP address, it's just IP.
Yeah.
And immediately, Yakov and Tony started talking faster than my brain could process. And,
I've met Tony Lee, and yes, I've seen that happen. And,
yeah.
I got the privilege to meet him at a couple of IETFs, and it's like, oh, yeah.
So, unfortunately for us, about 4 months after that, Tony went off and joined Juniper. And so there was a race on to get the first application we came up with was traffic engineering. And there was a big deal to sell routers to UUNet at the time. And UUNet required that, well, first I went down and showed UUNet what I was doing and what we were doing in Chelmsford. And they, you know, they very much liked the idea, and they ended up putting it into their RFP for the next generation routers. So there was a race on to produce traffic engineering.
So this, what do you mean by traffic engineering? Like the idea behind, let me just sort of recap for people who don't know. MPLS is, at the time of its inception in the mid-1990s, everybody was routing packets by IP addresses. It really wasn't the thing, you know, and the idea was is that most networks were actually private. There wasn't really a public internet in the early stages. That came much later. And
There was in the 90s.
Yeah, and UUNet was the core of the public internet at the time.
And it's important to say it was you know, destination IP routing, and then, and remember at the time too, ATM was hot, and frame relay too, right? So those were the predominant transports, right?
At the time, UUNet had a complete underlay of frame relay, and what traffic engineering allowed them to do was to eliminate that entire network.
So it moved a lot of the, what we were doing at that time is using ATM and frame relay to move, well, data around the network or something like that.
So, you know, you have to wind the movie back a long way and start thinking about, you know, the emergent technology then was it OC3 or OC12? I think it was OC12, which is pretty slow by today's standards. There was a great lack of bandwidth, and everybody was trying to squeeze as many bits down every pipe as they could. And so they were using frame relay in case of UUNet, and MCI, the other big player at the time, was using ATM to build these infrastructure that make the best of all the bandwidth that was there.
And remember at the time, too, there was a lot of efforts to try to do the stuff that we all ended up doing later in MPLS in ATM. Remember, there was Lane and blah 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 and all of those things they were trying.
That was the immediately follow on. It's all the stuff that and Dan can speak to this much better than I in terms of what we did with L3 VPNs. But the traffic engineering was you know, a great success. And what you were saying, that we were
when you say traffic engineering, what do you mean? Are you saying traffic shaping for bandwidth or
control? No. This is routing. Normally, IP sends things down the shortest path. Based on whatever metric is there. But the shortest path can get overcrowded if you're sending a lot of traffic in a particular direction, while other links might be underutilized. And this allows you to set up some alternative paths to the network.
So take a step back. What UUNet had done was to build a mesh between their routers using frame relay circuits over cascade switches. So rather than physically connecting the routers directly, they were connected with frame relay, DLCIs.
Right, because WANs in the old days, they weren't routed IP packets like they are today. Today, if you're thinking about this, it's...
Well, they were routed. They routed over those
frame relay circuits. They routed over them. Yeah, they were transport links.
It allowed them to route the layer 2 in a way to avoid congestion on the layer 1 links.
Yeah, well, in those days, we had frame relay, ATM, synchronous circuits, T1, E1, or fractional synchronous circuits.
So MCI had done the same thing using OC12.
Yeah.
Cisco was just in the process of coming out with the BFR, which supported OC12. Anyway, the idea that they wanted was to say, we're wasting bandwidth on ATM links at OC12. Cascade can't keep up. Cascade can't produce an OC12 switch. We'd like to be able to use those routers directly on the link, but we get a lot of benefit from the fact that we can engineer our layer 2 network.
Okay, so let me throw this at you then. So what we're saying is that at this era, all of the WANs were layer 2, and they were frame relay, ISDN, synchronous circuits, you know, SDLCs of some sort, or ATM circuits.
Not all, but the big providers.
Most of them, yeah.
Yeah, or some combination thereof. I was in Asia, and we had very different telecommunications to what happened in the US, and Europe had very different communications, again, like L2. But everybody had an L2, and the idea was is that you might run, and in that time, I remember running mostly NetBUI, or NetBIOS over NetBUI, SPX over IPX, and IP wasn't actually that much of a big deal in the mid-1990s. It was all the fact that most of us were running Novell NetWare, and it wasn't till much later that IP became a thing.
In enterprises, but this was a public network service.
This was public internet, for sure.
So you're saying the MPLS was then intended to be for public networks, and the idea was instead of routing on IP addresses, it was going to be routing on a tag that was inserted into the...
It was routing on IP addresses, but forwarding on a tag.
Remember it was called label switch controlled, LC...
Label switch routing, LSR.
ATM and frame relay. No, it was LC-ATM and LC-FR, actually, was what it was called. And that's kind of what Dan's getting at.
Okay.
You stand a router up next to a switch and control the switch. Eventually, you become the brains.
But that was later.
That was a little after. That's the next step.
Originally, UUNet, MCI were using primarily ATM switches to interconnect the routers. They wanted to get rid of that partly because they couldn't get the layer two switches to provide them with what they needed, and partly to avoid overhead. But they still wanted to be able to direct traffic in a layer 2.5 way. So that it didn't necessarily go between the two routers.
Is that because when you forward the IP header, you have to do, or forward an IP frame?
Well, take a step back. What they wanted was to say, we have this link between San Francisco and San Diego. It's overloaded. Mm. We'd like to route some of that traffic, say the stuff that's coming down from Oregon out by Utah. Mm-hmm. But the shortest path is going to just send it all down this San Francisco, San Diego link. So what we'd like to do is build a circuit of a sort from Oregon to Utah down to San Francisco over what looks like a two-hop length. Hmm. But the end result is the traffic is better balanced.
So you didn't want to route according to IP, IPX?
They wanted to route according to IP.
But they didn't want to route on the IP address.
They didn't want to make the decision.
They didn't want the shortest path to be selected based on the physical.
It was the decision. Count.
Okay. So I always had the sense that they wanted to still create A-B circuits. So the idea behind the label was that it still looked like an A end and a B end. It emulated a dial-up circuit because a dial-up circuit always has a start and
end. This kind of gets back to one of the major issues. This is going to be a too deep a dive and it's probably the right time to mention it. But there was this continual issue that people in the IETF and in parts of Cisco thought of MPLS as a layer 2 frame relay connection. They could not get out of their heads that it was just emulating frame relay. And, you know, you had Van Jacobsen writing tunnels versus cloud white papers and people having huge arguments. And in my mind, Packet MPLS, they always totally missed the point. Packet MPLS was a tunneling protocol. It allowed you to encapsulate at multiple levels and tunnel a forwarding decision from one part of the network to another part of the network. So, for example, traffic engineering, you had a labeled switch path that was set up by the control plane. The head end of that path could make a forwarding decision to send traffic down that path. At that point, it would be switched on the label in a layer 2 way. Across these things. That's the simplest version of it.
So,
But the more complex version of it is that you could have MPLS packets, you had the label stack. So you could have MPLS packets that were forwarded based on the connection to the packet between the routers, based on the IGP address.
So what you're saying is...
On top of that packet, you could have a label that caused it to go down a label switch path. Mm. A traffic engineer path. And underneath those labels, you could have a head end, an edge router that had decided that this packet belonged in a VPN and told the other end of that tunnel, here's a label, forward according to this VPN address. So you had multiple levels, a very efficient way to encode multiple layers of tunneling. Mm. And to me, that was all that the MPLS encapsulation was. Yeah. And people could not get that.
One very important thing to add here is that all those three layers could be done at the control level without any coordination beyond what they would normally do for IP.
Right. And once the switching was set up, it didn't really know anything about what was happening at any of those levels.
Yeah. If you think about MPLS purely, you know, from that standpoint, that it's a tunneling protocol, then all of the applications that a lot of network engineers associate with MPLS, L3 VPN, for example, or even traffic engineering, makes sense in that context. It's all just tunnels.
Right.
And in fact, for people listening to this today, you know, in 2017 or almost 18, these are the precursors to things like VXLAN and GRE and things like that, which are just other tunnels,
GRE,
right?
Came earlier. And if GRE was a tunneling protocol in an IP.
Yep.
Actually, it was for more than IP. And in fact, we had implementations of sending MPLS over GRE.
Correct. Yep. Hmm. So it's all a lot of it.
People
just
do that now.
You know?
Yeah, I always thought that when I started hearing about tag switching back in the late 90s, I always thought of it as NAT. The idea was that you were network address translating either Ethernet frames or IP packets into an MPLS tag, and then it just moved across the backbone as an MPLS tag, in exactly the same way that network address translation worked.
Well, that's like the definition of a tunnel. I mean, it's almost transparently shipped from A to B, right? Hmm. The ATM switches in the middle just saw them as cells. They didn't know what the context was other than the tag.
Yeah.
You know, the ATM tags, which are the same thing. Labels. Yeah. They were basically the same thing.
Yeah. The 48, 53 byte headers, 53 byte headers, bit headers. Sorry.
Yep. That was kind of my thinking of, you know, why this discussion is interesting for people today. Because I swear to God, I talk to somebody every couple of months who thinks tunnels were invented 6 months ago. And I said, you know, you gotta, you know, hold on. This is something we've been doing for a while, and really, a lot of what, in my opinion, what is different between today and 20 years ago is really just the control and setup and maintenance of the tunnel, right? Obviously, the encapsulation is a little different, but the concept is kind of the same.
Well, 20 years ago, the arguments about encapsulation formats were very passionate. And very, people had really rigid views on exactly what those encapsulation formats should be. And like the MPLS tag is only 20 bits. And I seem to remember that at the time, the arguments in the IETF were like,
oh, that's never going to be enough. Remember, George? You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
The very original MPLS application implementation, I don't know if I can say implementation, but aspect. It was more than 20 bits. It was something like 30 bits.
30.
But then Yakov had to cram it in to fit in it. He wanted the minimum packet to fit in an ATM cell. Mm-hmm. So he had to take the tag header down to one word.
And then somebody wanted QoS. Right.
Yeah.
We got that working, though. It was comical because, I mean, I think our implementation at the time could handle like 12 or 15 labels stacked on each other. I mean,
It could have handled essentially an arbitrary number.
There was but we had some hardware that could do that. I remember having discussions with customers going, no, that'll never be enough. I'm like, well, try it. We'll see.
12 layers of 12 tunnels inside of another tunnel, and they are sitting, but they weren't even doing that. Like if you were running Frame Relay or Fratum, you weren't doing that level of indirection in real life. Why would that
exactly? That was my point. I mean, you've got your label space is, you know, 20 time, you know, 20 to the 12th power here or whatever. Come on, you know, and we can see now 20 years later, it's sufficient. I mean, active networks today, they're running MPLS, the big ones that this conversation is traveling over probably several times is probably not doing more than 5 or 6, you know, max. And it's getting smaller because this.
But I think that is more due to the fact in the old days, a lot of stuff was done manually and it was done badly and divisions wouldn't talk to each other. And so, you know, there'd be a division doing the underlying bandwidth and then there'd be another division running this region and then there'd be another division running the sub region. And then all of their networks are still isolated and uncoordinated. But over time, we've developed software that starts to...
Well, you remember, Dan probably remembers, this was actually one of the driving motivators for some enterprise use of this stuff, which was department segregation for L3 VPN, not to kind of change the subject, but you know, it's just another label.
Yeah. Yep.
But on your side, you know, getting rid of the Frame Relay network meant you were, consolidating all those engineers into one group that just ran routers and made them do all kinds of kinds of tricks, but everybody knew what everybody was doing to a much greater degree than they did when they were, you know, down the hall or over in another building.
And there's also the area where this was back in the days when bandwidth was precious. You know, every drop was to be conserved. And moving to routing over MPLS was a substantial reduction in bandwidth in terms of propagation, wasn't it?
It was a much better use, much better economical use of the bandwidth. They were able to deliver a lot more packets with the same infrastructure.
But that was the traffic engineering application, largely.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Well, there's two sides to it. You weren't using, you know, IP over frame relay, or, you know, multiple IPs over multiple frame relays and burning up resources, because each path programmed in a switch, be it frame relay or ATM, consumed TCAM space inside of, and there wasn't a lot of it at the time. That silicon of the day was quite limited.
Yeah, it was limited enough. I mean, but still remember that in the core, if you've got for whatever application, VPN, whatever, or TE over the core labels that are used between the core routers, there's basically one label space. And you're only switching on the bottom, the topmost label at the time, you know, until you get to the edge. So actually that's kind of not that big of a concern. And again, that gets into the 20 bits thing, like, you know.
Yeah, the core would target BFOs, which were not using TCAMs at the time. And they could forward, I think the target was 1 million prefixes and the full label space, 1 million labels, basically. And so label space, forwarding table space wasn't the big issue nearly as much as bandwidth utilization on the physical link.
Yeah, keeping them full.
That was
the other thing. Like as after we got past OC12, I remember having these discussions about now we can't keep the thing full. We can't pump the links fast enough. And that was, you know, this sort of oversubscription at the edge was kind of one way to help with that. Cores were almost never oversubscribed, even today.
Hmm.
You know, so it's a matter of, like, you know, like George was saying, you know, using what you've installed and to its fullest, right?
So with MPLS, we've got the labels. We've decided to put a tag, or a label inside of the IP header, and now we're moving forward. Why did we choose the label distribution protocol to distribute labels instead of flipping it into something else?
Well, we didn't.
Yeah.
Right. So we came up with TDP, tag distribution protocol, as a peer-to-peer label distribution protocol. Mm-hmm. Originally, the idea was that would be used for everything. I mean, there had to be something, right? So we ended
up something to do the mapping function, basically.
Something had to tell the routers that for this thing, this is the label that goes with it.
Right.
Now, and as it turned out, we didn't use LDP for the traffic engineering paths, and that was a very contentious thing that George can say a lot more about. we didn't use LDP for L3 VPN, and that was, I believe, a good engineering decision because BGP was a good match for distributing the routes for that, and it was easy to piggyback labels on that. We did, I don't know where the L2 stuff has gone, but originally we did use L2, the original L2 stuff, to just go back to this traffic engineering thing. We had these guys doing traffic engineering, they won traffic engineering, UUNET was happy with it. And we were sure, and then we had implemented, I believe, we had implemented the first version of L3 VPN. It might not have quite shipped yet, but it was basically there. And then Digix came in and said, yeah, this is all cool, but we really would like to be able to sell a frame relay service. So I kind of whipped up a prototype of frame relay, encapsulating frame relay in MPLS. I came up with the...
So you're encapsulating frame relay in IP MPLS or just adding an MPLS tag to the frame relay?
There was a tag and there was a pseudo wire header.
Mm.
This is the beginning of pseudo wires, by the way.
Right.
So the pseudo wire is being routed to an IP address. But
so the pseudo, tunneling. This is tunneling.
This is another tunnel.
We're sending a packet from one edge router, which has a frame relay link on it, to another edge router that's a frame router. They find.
So you're saying IP would come. So
the edge router is a speaking literally frame relay. They've been configured.
But receiving IP packets over the frame relay.
Nope, they're receiving frame relay packets.
Right.
Frame
so packets. Then you would encapsulate the frame relay packet in an IP packet.
The frame relay packet, and they want to forward this packet to another router,
right?
Another edge of the network. So now they slap on top. So they take that packet. They negotiate between those two edge routers a label that says this label corresponds to this DLCI.
Yeah.
This circuit. Then on top of that label, they can put another label, an IGP level label, that forwards that packet across the backbone to that other edge router. So now we have a two-level stack.
Right. So now you have one backbone which is carrying IP packets and frame relay packets at the same time.
But it doesn't know it. That's
it doesn't know it.
Yeah, it could be carrying IP packets. It could be carrying voice. It could be carrying Ethernet. We don't care.
Yep.
So my point was, I just wanted to sell the service. I whipped up the basic encapsulation. It's my fault that the sequence number space, the ordering space is too small.
It was only meant to be a hack, right?
No, well, 16 bits was plenty big for frame relay. It was just once you started going down to 48 or something, it's not nearly big enough. Anyway, at that point, we had that, and somebody also showed it to Luca Martini at Label 3, and he said, wow, that's a great thing. I should try to standardize this.
I was going to say, you should tell the it crashes, but it works story.
I don't even remember the details, but basically I had a working thing. And because we had LDP, I mean, came into this via this conversation talking about LDP. Because LDP existed as a way to transport labels with an arbitrary mapping, I used LDP to carry the DLCI mapping. I just defined a new TLV rather than setting an IGP.
And that is why TLVs are important, kids. You should always use TLVs.
Exactly.
Extensible TLVs in your routing protocols, because you can add stuff without having to reinvent the protocol.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now we had four different label, if I counted right, four different label distribution protocols, right? We had LDP for IGP level labels. We had LDP for pseudo wires. We had RSVP being used for traffic engineering, and you'd want to talk to Yakov and Dave Katz as to why that happened. And we had BGP being used for layer 3 VPNs.
And basically what you were doing there was just using whatever was around. Like RSVP was left over from the QoS implementations, but it was a signaling protocol between endpoints. So you were able to just...
Right. And it had encodings that mapped more or less to the semantics they needed for traffic engineering.
I mean, in every case here, I mean, what happened was we had an encapsulation, and this is like, one of the things I was doing a lot of work on was the pseudowire stuff. It was like a Swiss Army knife at the end here, where what you had was an encapsulation mapping, effectively. Then you had to figure out, how to get that mapping to other places, like at least to the other end. One of the things too that came out around this time too was static. We were having fights about, should we let people actually manually assign labels and things, which of course, fast forward to, 4 or 5 years ago when everybody was, OpenFlow was all the rage. That's effectively the same thing, right? Mm. It was static label assignment for a tunnel.
Yeah, I always say, let's take a detour there. What's your opinion of OpenFlow? I sort of came up with the view that OpenFlow is kind of like a universal definition of all flows, in the sense that MPLS is a flow definition, IP routing ends up being a flow definition for a given source destination pairing. Do you have opinions one way or another about whether OpenFlow is going to end up? I mean, is ultimately OpenFlow where we're going to end up, but we've got to get something to go through before we get there?
I think OpenFlow is kind of toast at this point, by the way. Everybody's moved on to P4 and whatever else for that. But.
Yeah. My opinion of OpenFlow is it's sort of... machine language level programming for networks.
Yeah, that's what it always was to me. It was like a universal way of describing packet recognition and flow operations.
Right, now, but nobody writes in machine language anymore, unless they're building a BIOS or something.
And it's a scale thing. Like humans and even operational systems are not necessarily designed to control that kind of amount of static programming. And this is the argument, like, I remember, like, one of these conferences that I went, like the one in Paris, I think, was the one where Yakov and I were arguing against OpenFlow as the shiny new penny at the beginning, where we said was it's just static routes. And then static routes are the 5-tuple, 7-tuple, whatever tuple.
Mm. Yep, yep.
Right? I mean, that's effectively what it is. And then, and that's really ultimately where OpenFlow broke down. You know, if you found like how Big Switch, you know, fell on their face in the early days was, you know, they wanted to send, you know, basically all unknown traffic to a centralized controller. And, you know, we've seen that movie 8 or 9 times now.
Yeah, Lane had that problem too.
Lane, Flow, yeah. Flow, you know, Ypsilon, you know, the road is littered.
But don't you think that it's a bit like also, but it's like modern computers today where we don't actually care so much about wasting computer cycles because there's plenty of them.
Well, that was a tragic argument for OpenFlow. People said, oh, well, computing power is so much power, more powerful now, 10 years later, we can do this. Mm. Well, you know, math is still math.
I thought that the issue was that there were a bunch of people in the carrier who had been selling TDM services and such based on that sort of a model, a central database where everything was provisioned. And they kept wanting... And every time we would talk to a carrier, there would be some people who understood IP and some people who were in the ATM, TDM world. Bellheads. Yeah, that's a way. Is that a swear? And they really wanted that thing. So we said, fine, we'll give you static labels. No one, as far as I know, nobody ever used them at the time. But they wanted them because it matched what they were comfortable with.
Yeah, that was the beginning of GMPLS, that whole thing.
Oh, the attempt to build a universal MPLS that solved all problems?
Yeah.
Basically taking the tunnel routing protocol and applying it to all other transport technologies.
You might need to go into that a little bit more detail or break it down to something a little simpler.
The current thing that people are doing with it is switching light waves.
Okay,
so,
yeah.
So based on the color of a light wave, they can route it through a switch and... You know, so you build long connections that go through.
See, that comes back to circuits again. Every time I talk to people about MPLS, I always end up back at a circuit, an 8-point.
Yeah, but it has not. It has nothing to. You know, this is working in a totally different universe, and it's not part of a router.
Wave switched optical networks. The idea is you want to switch a wavelength. But you want to hop from path to path depending on wavelength. You don't actually want to have a label switch path. You want a wavelength. Yeah,
but a wavelength.
But we had built so much stuff for traffic engineering at that point that people wanted just to glom onto that rather than starting over from scratch.
Right. So basically, you had a signaling protocol. I mean, it's the opposite, right? So we started with RSVP because it was there. Hmm. Now, once traffic engineering had been built on top of RSVP, you now had a general way to signal a label for an NLRI.
Yeah.
Then generalize the NLRI to be whatever you want it to be, and you could generalize the label to be whatever you want it to be, and you can use that to program the ATM switches.
Through TDM. It could be a time slot in
it could
TDM.
Be TDM. It could be a...
It was just another label to everything. Function to an optical thingy or whatever.
Did it ever, like, one of the problems with all of this, of course, has been that the RSVP code or the LDP code or the BGP code has been less than excellent. Did it ever occur to you that using these substandard protocols like RSVP to carry this, to be these control panes was a bad idea?
The only protocols that are really, really, really good are the ones that are in people's minds. As soon as you build it.
There's the quote of the day.
but I mean, RSVP was an awful protocol. It was really unreliable, and it didn't establish very well. And over low bandwidth links, it failed to communicate and connect properly. And there's weaknesses in the implementation that you could drive a truck through. You know, it seems like you just chose it because, you know, you wrote it and you had to do something and you did it in a hurry.
Well, I mean, things get out in the field and they get ruggedized. I mean,
yeah. But see, to me, that's wrong, right? The thing about networking is we keep throwing these turds over the wall, and then people pick them up and go, geez, I like the smell of that. And next thing you know, you've got this network which falls over every which way. And as engineers, we're being blamed left, right, and center for delivering a substandard service. And we're still trying to ruggedize these MPLS networks 15 years down the line, and they're still unstable today. Well, like, most carriers can barely keep their backbones operational for days, much less months.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of complexity to doing this. And I think that's what I was saying. What's happening today is a lot of the changes in the technology today have nothing to do with the underlying network. They just assuming, you know, I did a bunch of very large scale open daylight deployments over the last couple of years. There was no desire to change the network. There was just a change in how to operate the network.
But they're frightened of changing the network because it's such a house of cards that if you change anything, you know it's just going to fall down in a big stinking pile.
I'm not going to speak to ISVP, but the reason BGP was chosen was exactly the opposite reason. BGP was the stable, scalable network protocol. That had, I mean, it was deployed all over the network. It was running. That was the argument. And
the internet runs because of BGP.
Right.
It runs in spite of BGP is actually the correct answer.
Well, it may be, but you can't, again, as George said, I'm sure there's a theoretical protocol that would have run better.
Yeah.
LDP was done from scratch. So you can't say we threw LDP over the wall. We designed a protocol to distribute labels. Now, BGP was designed as the mechanisms in BGP were these scalable mechanisms that the best we knew to distribute millions of routes.
BGP has now gotten to the point where it's so bad, we actually have companies sitting on top of the internet trunking traffic into their overlay to bypass the worst parts of the network of the internet.
It's not that it's so bad. It's just that it's working as designed, which doesn't happen to be optimized for traffic flows. And so, you've got a bunch of companies that are able to engineer, in spite of BGP, they go around it to optimize.
I think it's the opposite of that. And I mean, we've said this a bunch of times in this conversation where, you know, like we could going back to pseudowires, going back to other, you know, we had a protocol that was designed to do something and we stretched it and we stretched it some more. We said, you know, there's only so far you can roll the pizza dough out before you poke a hole in it. And like BGP, the inside joke about BGP is we all call it a dump truck because it carries everybody's trash around. Because it keeps carrying the trash around, everybody's happy, even though it might be slower or
take a wrong turn. It's not just me. My point of criticizing BGP is to highlight the fact that, yes, it works. And yes, if it works, it's not if it's stupid, but it works, it's not stupid. But that doesn't mean that it's not, we couldn't have done it better. Now, I'll agree, we can't fix BGP because trying to get people to change BGP right now, I don't think that's going to happen in the next 50 years. People are always going to use BGP to signal between autonomous systems, but you could certainly replace BGP inside your autonomous system and start routing traffic smart instead of dumb like we do today.
Well, but on the other hand, there are people that are putting BGP in their data centers now, right? You know, Google and Microsoft do this. It's very public. There's the flip side, right? People are going, no, let's
that's what they use today, but they're already moving away from that. And, you know, OpenR is a step in a direction of a post-BGP world. Whether OpenR wins or survives, perhaps, you know, as you say, once it gets into the field, will it survive? But I suspect that, you know, people who are using BGP, they're not using it as a routing protocol. They're using it as a messaging bus. And as a messaging bus, BGP is a really good email server.
Good, I am.
Greg, I think there's a subtle difference here in that we're criticizing BGP, but BGP's, Tom, to go back to your analogy, stretched so far beyond its original design that who we should really be criticizing are the people that keep dumping things into BGP, not BGP itself so much. Maybe there's no difference there. I don't know, and I'm making one where there isn't one. But I feel like
the same argument every time, whether we're in standards or wherever. This exact conversation happens. Okay, so should we stop abusing BGP this time? Nah, let's add another one in. What the hell?
It'll take another one.
I think the thing to take away here is that, you know, why do we use RSVP for MPLS-CE? Because it just happened to be there, and the person who was there started to use RSVP because they knew it. Or why do we use LDP? Or why do we use, you know, these protocols? And the answer was they were there. We're not smart enough in networking to actually sit down and think carefully. And this, by the way, is not just networking, but in computing. Don't have some sort of, you know, view of these protocols as arcane, God-given, written on tablets, right tool for the job, designed from the ground up. They never were. They're the Microsoft Word of their generation, really.
Well, part of it is not, it's not that we just picked up whatever was around. It was also, I mean, we were in companies that were, you know, presumably trying to make a profit and all that. And so, you know, spending 9 months designing a new protocol and then getting the world to agree with you to use it, you know, there's a certain cost associated with that.
I seem to remember that back in those days, you never wanted to run the same protocol as your competitors. Everybody wanted to be proprietary.
Juniper, Cisco, I mean, Dan brought up, you know, remember VPLS, they wanted to use RSVP for VPLS instead of LDP. And, you know, and there were all of these comical arguments about let's use A, B, or C just because the other guy used one of the other letters, you know. You know, it's not, I don't think it's as black and white as, you know, hey, we just picked this thing up and wrapped some baling wire and bubblegum around it. I mean, there was a lot of thought, careful consideration around this. I wouldn't characterize it as that flip, you know.
Yeah.
There are a lot of smart people.
A lot of people. Definitely. But I think the point that I want to make to people is who tell me that you can't criticize BGP or MPLS because, you know, they're absolutely perfect and, you know, as designed for the solution. I'm going like,
oh, it's far from that.
And that's the myth I'm trying to dispel is that, you know, they are the best possible choice from a range of choices that could be made.
They suck less than the other options is how I would say.
they're the best worst.
BGP was the best choice at the time.
Yeah.
It's been 20 years since, and I haven't been involved for 10 years, so I have no clue what's happening now. It was the best choice for a long time for that application. Mm. OSVP was an okay choice. we had long fights about OSVP versus LDP, both inside and outside of Cisco. LDP was designed from scratch, you know, so it's
from another guy in our group. Yeah, Bob, who's not
Bob Thomas.
Bob Thomas. So it was purpose built from scratch, from the ground up, and the same thing happened, right? It was designed to distribute labels, basically like for the core, and then all of a sudden somebody said, "Hey, let's use this for L2 VPN now," you know, and that's another stretching operation, right?
Yeah.
So,
but you needed something with most of the same properties.
Correct.
So the fact that all you were carrying was an additional piece of information was not a big deal.
See, and the other thing too, Ethan, is that, you know, one of the issues is the carriers, right? You know, I was there when you'd rock up to a carrier with a new protocol. And, you know, this takes literally like a year, over a year sometimes to get them convinced, you know, and that means testing and not just talking. But there's a lot of legwork to get a new protocol versus one that they're used to. They have testing and philosophical agreement with. To say, hey, look, we're going to add 20% to this thing.
What's that? And it's also true that in that era, the carriers also thought they knew better than anybody else.
They still do, but
I think broadly there's a lot more humility these days than there was, in that carriers realize they're part of an ecosystem. I mean, look at the emergence of the cloud companies to all of a sudden be, it used to be like enterprise and carrier, and that was it. And now there's enterprise, carrier, and cloud. And it's really changed the face of the market. And a lot of the time the carrier, like enterprise IT, doesn't lead anything. They just get the scraps that fall off the table from the carriers. And the carriers now are starting to get the scraps that fall off the table of the cloud companies because they're the people who are growing and innovating and willing to do new things in a hurry. Like, and this is like, so today some of the cloud carriers use MPLS internally, but increasingly they're moving away from MPLS completely and abandoning it because it's not enough for what they want to do.
Yeah, flat Ethernet or something, you know, something like that.
They build an IP fabric and then they run everything over the top in an overlay that's been orchestrated by software. They started off with MPLS 10 years ago, but now they're long gone. They might be using MPLS tags to forward packets, but they're not using LDP to distribute them or the label. They're not using label control planes like we would recognize in a traditional networking setting that are defined by the IETF, I don't think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's still tunneling going on. Overlays are just tunnels with a new fancy name, you know, and there's a different control protocol or control scheme that's used, you know, to set up and manage and operate that stuff. You know, it's this saying, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Mm. Well, is that actually where we're at with MPLS then, where it has been supplanted by and large, or are there still fairly significant MPLS networks out there?
My opinion is the latter. I don't know about you guys. Pick any tier one telco that's out there today, they're running MPLS, you know.
You know, and in the case of AT&T, all but the control traffic goes over MPLS.
Yeah.
Everything. The carriers wanted to put voice over packet for a long time, but they were too nervous that IP wasn't quite reliable enough.
Yeah, and they always wanted to carry it natively on the L2.
Traffic engineering not only allowed them to guarantee the quality of service for voice, but it also implemented a thing called fast reroute, which would, after you detected a failure, it would reroute it within a few
Yeah. Sub 50 millisecond reconvergence. Yeah.
Way below that.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, when that got tried and true, that was when they were finally willing to put all the voice over packet. And,
so I remember when that was, you know, one of the first cases of that, right? Was the 21C network, right? You know, very public network. Everybody can, you know, can see all that stuff now. But that's basically what they did, right? They built a PSTN voice transport network with TE, effectively.
As I remember, they weren't even using TE except just to build the bypass tunnels.
It was literally built to simulate the PSTN network, right? So there were an amazingly high number of equal cost paths everywhere to, you know, for every conceivable disaster scenario. I ran that network for 3 years or whatever when I was there. It was way overbuilt, but it was because of what George said. People still didn't trust IP.
Mm.
We had arguments then where we had video running from my house here in New Hampshire, streaming movies to London and showing people, you know, basically the predecessor to Hulu and Netflix. We were working on building that, and they were 80% of the people in the room, you know, were scoffing at that, saying, "This is impossible. This is it's got to be some kind of charade going on here. You can't possibly be streaming these bits from 3,000 miles away." So it's that kind of thing, right? And you guys, Dan and George, you guys saw this all over the place, right?
Even me as a lowly field engineer back in the day, we were getting, remember, the 3810s and doing voice over frame relay, like native voice over frame relay and stuff like that. And it was all very weird. It never worked. When we did voice over L2, it literally never worked. So I never enjoyed that.
One thing I wanted to get back to was, question was, you know, why didn't you put things in the IGP? And another question is, anything new happening in MPLS? And the answer is very much a yes, but the people doing it decided to rename it to segment routing.
Mm.
And segment routing puts, labels in the IGP to carry IP addresses. And, it is the new thing that allows, in a data center, you can program the entire path of a packet in the application.
Yes.
And route it all the way out to the BGP exit point, not just to the router, but to the very peering link.
See, that sounds like OpenFlow to me, the idea that you set the path at source.
Right, but you do it all. You do all this with MPLS labels.
Oh yeah, no. Sorry, Doug, I don't disagree. But the principles behind segment routing, it seems to me like you're predicated on the fact that I've got 25 years of substandard legacy technology, and I'm not willing to start again and do it right. So I have to carry along the ball and chain that I've got, and continue to propagate the misery that we already have.
Just to be clear, which piece of substandard are you talking about? The label forwarding?
Yeah.
The label distribution?
Control planes, the provisioning algorithms,
like
the expertise, the quality of the software in the boxes, the lack of carriers, lack of ability to replace them over time.
That's just the world. It's the way it works, right?
Yeah.
You've got expertise in the
progress relies on the unreasonable man.
You guys that are working on the IETF standards and so on, how is MPLS segment routing different from traffic engineering? Because at the service level, they sound very similar in what they would achieve.
Segment routing is using a controller to do what RSVP does. And that's about it.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I mean, all of these things for the last 10 years have effectively been just a change in the tunnel encapsulation or the thing that controls setting that up.
Yeah.
Setting up the tunnel path setting up the A end. Yeah.
So Clarence Fieseus would disagree with me violently, but I view segment routing, at least the part that uses the MPS control plane, to basically be a marriage between MPLS and SDN.
Mm-hmm. No, he might disagree with you, but in certainly the way that Cisco's positioning it is, that's what they see segment routing is. They see it as a way of programming an MPLS network using segment routing as an API whereas the existing MPLS protocols we have are sort of SDN resistant.
Yeah, and I think that's a fair characterization. And like if you talk to like John Brozovsky, some of the other guys at Comcast who publicly talked about this at the ITF and whatnot, that's kind of why they're interested in using it. One of the reasons, there's other reasons, but one of the reasons is, again, and this gets back to what I said like a half an hour ago, is that most of the changes these days are about operation and control. Yeah. And the controller, the whole controller, SDN controller, is used as a way to shortcut the whole configuration thing that happens on these devices. You know, whether you're using NetConf or RestConf or whatever, right? There's a whole, lock the system, verify the change, push the change into the config, write the thing, reply. And one of the things I found, like in one of my last ODL deployments, we weren't using SR segment routing, but we were using some of the other modifications in PSEP to do rapid modifications to tunnels that would take, I could push a change to a tunnel's configuration in about 5 seconds. If I pushed that same config to a Cisco or a Juniper router in that same network, it literally would take almost a minute. Mm. And so depending on what your commercial operational situation is, that may or may not.
I think the thing is, but one of the things that I've actually been thinking heavily about trying to predict what are the major themes for 2018. And while 2017 was dominated by things like SD-WAN and the ongoing speed increases, things like 200 gig and 400 gig, those types of technologies, the thing that I think is going to be very big for 2018 is actually going to be this efficiency and speed. My network is too slow. My operational efficiency is so poor. I have people doing, literally out there with rocks and bits of wood trying to build networks like in the command line. Mm-hmm. Why have I not got a factory to produce network operations? Why is it not automated or simplified or, the friction in all of this is way too high. So configuring an MPLS network is so impossibly difficult that customers are going, I don't want MPLS anymore. It's got to be a better way.
I don't think that's the technology. I think that's partially sort of like what the reason why you and Ethan are doing something else. It's the major vendors, they convince people that they need to do this stuff. Hmm. That example you gave of the network we were talking about last week about, everything's pre-provisioned and then it's just activated when you turn on the network port, all the config. I mean, there are ways to do this in simple ways. I don't think blaming the technology, because I could set up I have an MPLS running here in part of my home network. It's not rocket science to set it up. It's just a lot of network operators, this is what I've observed, is they don't know enough about the technology or enough to design their own network. And so what they do is let the vendors design the network for them, and then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
They still don't know enough on how to manage the network day to day. And then I've got a fundamental rant here, which is that salespeople go into carriers and say, no, get rid of those headcount and spend the money with us, and we'll definitely give you an operational efficiency. And then, of course, what they've now got is the Ferrari, but nobody to drive it, because you need to have a specialist driver to be able to drive a Ferrari. You need a Ferrari licensed driver to make it go.
And a mechanic to work on it every
week. And a mechanic to work on it, and you need a workshop to keep the Ferrari in peak condition. Yeah. And, of course, the sales rep has done anything for the deal, promised anything, lied to anything, exaggerated everything. And, of course, the carrier goes and reduces the headcount before the deal goes through, because that's how they're paying for it. And then suddenly they've got a network they can't operate or stabilize or fix or even do basic maintenance on. And mm-hmm. that ultimately is where SDN's coming in. And I think this is where MPLS falls down too, is because it is for a large number of people to operate it and maintain it. It's deeply impractical because the protocols that underlie it are unstable and unreliable. They're not easily understood. They're not practically usable by ordinary people in everyday situations. And it's a technology from a different era where people did have the time, did have the to sit down and learn and to read and to think and to talk to the people. I spent the last 10 years of my networking career alone. There was nobody in my team that I had got to work with. So if I had to learn something, I had to learn it by the hard way, configuring it or from a textbook. And, the old ideas of, learning on the job or learning from people around you, that's done. That era, that left 10, 15 years ago. And this idea that complex, reuse of protocols, reuse of existing systems, you know, keep building on the legacy. Don't worry about it. We'll just slap another layer of concrete over the top and keep going and it'll be right for another 5 years. I think is really, this is where public cloud suddenly they're doing fine because guess what they did? They tore it all down and started again. And they're willing to tear it down consistently.
Yeah, I guess there's, you know, part of, you know, what you're saying, there's some truth to that, you know, the operational challenges. But I, you know, I've seen it firsthand. I mean, like you're saying, the vendor often sells the operator a deal that they really shouldn't be accepting.
Strategy.
You know, part of it is, you know, I mean, you know, we were talking about this the other day, too. I mean, you know, the usual suspects go in and they throw in, you know, whatever certifications you can get and all that. And, you know, after this, you know, what it does is it forms a certain culture at this operator. And, you know, I've heard this when I've gone into the trying to sell the controller over the last couple of years. When I've gone into different places, I swear to God, twice I heard, you know, does that work on my, you know, Cisco-powered network? Or will this work on my Juniper JCIE, you know, network? Will that be enough to help me operate this? And I was like, what are you talking about? but it's a case in point, right? It's that it, you know, that's a perfect example of, how people get hooked on a thing and then they just, oh, of course, I need more of that thing, you know?
Yeah. I do think it's changing. I think that people have sort of woken up to the fact that the world is turning over and that there are new ways of doing things. In particular, I think that certain customers are wary of that being oversold and overpromised, and they realize that promises in the sales cycle never come true. And I think also people are losing faith with the brands. In the same way that other people are losing faith with brands, I think that's also coming true as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And one of the things that I'm seeing is as part of that, you know, and to address some of the stuff that we were just talking about is simplification of the network. So people aren't going and ripping MPLS out or whatever, but they're definitely simplifying it in certain ways that, you know, may or may not actually at the end of the day be simplifications, but they're trying to do things like reduce the amount of protocols that are run, you know, reduce all of the various tunneling technologies, not just MPLS, that are going on, right? And so then, you know, this is kind of the appeal of SD-WAN. You know, this is a good segue into that. It's just L3 VPN with a controller instead of using the sort of inline embedded control plane. But it's viewed as being easier because it's over the top and some of the control functions are kind of orthogonal to the service provider providing the transport for it.
But the irony here is if you take us back to the beginning of this discussion and why traffic engineering was attractive to the carriers, it was for exactly the same reason.
Exactly that.
they had people who understood BGP and they had other operational groups who understood, who had to set up these frame relay circuits on these cascade switches. And to them, the idea of being able to simplify it down to just using Cisco Juniper routers for everything was so attractive.
So I remember. Yeah.
The more things change, the more things stay the same.
That's called in business strategy.
What it was.
Yeah. In strategic terms or business strategy terms, it was called building a moat. So the vendors always made their products compliant or interoperable up to a point, but then a point past that, and that actually made customers loyal to them
That's happening, but that wasn't why the customers wanted it. The customers wanted it because they understood how to run a large BGP network, the people we were talking to. Yeah. So to them, the idea that L3 VPN used BGP was great because it meant we don't have to learn this new protocol. We trust BGP to be able to scale.
That's right. And you know what that degrades down to today? That's we can't learn something new because we can't learn something new. So instead of having you look at programmers, they go through language after language, you know, like they've gone from Python to Ruby to Go, you know, to Rust to R to whatever. They change.
And back again.
And back again, right? And Java and all of the evils that the world gives us, JavaScript and PHP. In server land, people continue to change from Linux versions to Linux version, from distro to distro, move around. In every other part of technology, not so much storage. Storage is like networking. We've got this, you know, mindset of bunkered mindset. But in networking, it's always like, oh, we can't change. We can't change because we can't learn something new. We've got to stay stuck 30 years in the past because, you know, like we can't teach anybody anything new. That's absolute bunk.
That's always why it's been. I mean, that's always been that way. That's why we went from, we were developing dynamic traffic circuit setup protocols, GMPLS. The carriers didn't want that because they didn't fear their operational groups could understand it. That's how OpenFlow or whatever was before OpenFlow came about.
That's also how we got label switch controlled.
But that mindset
relate too is the same reason.
My point is that, you know, continuing to use protocols like MPLS and BGP propagates that mindset. It continues that fossil fuel analogy. People keep telling me that electric cars are never going to be out.
15 years ago, MPLS and BGP were the new things.
Yes.
And it was the mindset of the operational people who were just...
BGP wasn't new. People felt that BGP
was... No, but MPLS as a way to do what you were previously doing, or RSVP, whatever, the functionality.
Yeah, my point is that we need an electric car. Electric cars are going to take all the fossil fuels and all the other cars and put them off the road.
And in 10 or 20 years, we'll need an atomic-powered car. It's always going to change.
Yep. Networking hasn't.
I mean, in networking, we were the cool kids. I remember going in and having these epic arguments with bellheads, right? And it was the same, you know, sort of we're like the bellheads now, I suppose.
So it's changed because now MPLS is the bellhead, exactly. I mean, the fundamental issue isn't going to change. The details of which protocol you're saying is the sucky old thing, that's going to keep evolving. But it always, I mean, I've been in computers for, I don't know, since 1975, right? And it's always changing. It is always something old that's sucky and should be thrown out and something new that's better. But it is always the same. So, yeah, you'll be making the same rant in 10 years with whatever replaces MPLS.
I probably won't because I'll have had enough by then.
Well, that's why I'm not making the rant because I have enough.
And that's probably a good point to start thinking about wrapping this up. Do you want to give us any final points or any final thoughts on where you think we are?
You know, I think the more things change, the more they stay the same in some ways. I mean, I see in a lot of ways the need for simplification and optimization of things today, but that doesn't mean that, you know, we didn't solve a lot of the problems that, you know, or address the requirements that exist today 10, 15 years ago or whatever. You know, I think some of the solutions that are coming out today are largely a variation on the theme. And like we've been talking about for the last hour, you know, it comes down to, in a lot of ways, the fundamental discovery in MPLS was tunnels, right? And I'm pretty sure tunnels, you know, existed before then. But that, to me, was, you know, sort of one of the main, you know, salient parts of the thing. And then the other part is, you know, how do you control that tunnel? How do you lay it down? How do you manage it? How do you tear it down? And those are things that we're going to continue iterating on forever. You know, there's going to be a better way, faster way, whatever, or maybe just a different way. So I guess that's why this is all fun for me.
I think that tunnels and overlays are certainly going to be where we're going to be for quite some time. The efficiencies and the value of those is going to continue indefinitely, and that, you know, everywhere we go, that orchestration of tunnels and overlays makes perfect sense for the time being. There's no reason to believe that that's not going to scale or solve all of the problems. So,
So to build on what Tom was saying, there are a lot of tunneling protocols, and there were a lot around before MPLS. But MPLS was the first one to be that efficient, that you put on one more label and you've got another whole tunnel. And the other genius of MPLS was to not have a fixed header, but to have a label stack so that you could have as many different control protocols getting in and working independently of each other, but affecting their responsibility for a packet, but not having to coordinate. So you put all these stacks, you stack these labels on, and then the right thing happens all the way through the network. And it's allowed us to, you know, add new protocols in and now add SDN in as a way of controlling this label stack.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to wrap it up, and that's the final podcast we're recording in 2017. So thanks very much for joining us today, Tom Nadeau, who's Dan Tappan, and George Swallow. It's been great to have you here to talk about some history of MPLS. I hope you got something out of it. Thanks for listening to the Packet Pushers today. You can find this and many more fine free technical podcasts, along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter as @packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn, like us on Facebook, and rate us on Apple Podcasts. And last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.